Welcome back to The Hidden Agenda, a podcast brought to you by Changing Relations. I'm Primrose, a student at Durham University and an intern at Changing Relations, and in this episode I'll be talking to Dr. Stephen Burrell about the issues of gendered violence, such as domestic abuse and sexual violence, particularly at Durham University itself. If this is at all a topic you find disturbing, do feel free to stop listening at any point. But without further ado, on with the podcast. Dr. Stephen Burrell, hello and welcome to the podcast. Could you introduce yourself and tell me a bit more just about what your work is and what your research is and a little bit about what you're doing with Changing Relations?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Primrose, and thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here. So I'm a researcher in the Department of Sociology at Durham University. I'm just starting an early career fellowship with the Leverhulme Trust. My research focuses on men and masculinities in particular, I suppose. In relation to that, I'm particularly interested in violence and abuse and how to prevent gender-based violence or violence against women. And in particular, I suppose, the positive role that men and boys can play in that. And so how to engage with men and boys around promoting that violence prevention work. And in particular, in relation to that, I guess, how to change kind of harmful ideas and norms around masculinity and how to promote gender equality. Because, you know, for me, I see those things as very much linked to preventing violence against women. So that's what my research is all about. Although I'm actually just moving in a new direction now with my current research, looking at environmental harm and thinking about how that relates to men and masculinities as well, but still very much connected to the previous work I've done. So with Changing Relations, I'm the co-chair of the steering group for Changing Relations, which has just started. Before that, we had a management board, so I was on the management board, and I think I joined that in 2017. So yeah, I just helped to kind of inform and shape the work that Changing Relations do, so it's great to be part of the organization because they do such exciting and fantastic work. So yeah.
Great, thank you so much. So what does engaging men and boys sort of look like practically, or yeah, in your research, what does that really look like?
Yeah, well, it could look like lots of different things, to be honest. I mean, it could be formally or it could be informal. So on a more organized basis, I suppose it's doing things like education, training, workshops, that could be in schools or colleges or universities, or it could be in the workplace or in communities, trying to just basically, as the word suggests, like engage men and boys in conversations around masculinity and violence and sexism and gender inequality, just trying to start conversations with them really about those issues, encourage men and boys to think more critically about those things and their own kind of their own positions and experiences in relation to those things, and to think about, I suppose, what kind of positive role can all of us play in challenging things like violence and abuse or I suppose gender inequality and the kind of sexism and misogyny that often underpins that, really. It can be on a more organized basis, and there are quite a few organizations in the UK and across the world who are doing really great work in that area. Some organizations work specifically with men and boys, but then of course lots of organizations like Changing Relations will work with any groups, but as part of that will of course be engaging with quite a lot of men and boys as part of that process. But then it could also be, on a more informal basis as well. Men having conversations with each other, whether that's their friends or family members or colleagues. And again, just I suppose, encouraging like critical thinking in relation to these issues and perhaps challenging unhealthy behaviours when they encounter them. And I think for me, a key part of it really is about it's not just about having conversations. It is actually about changing some of our attitudes and stereotypes and assumptions and our behaviours, and encouraging, I suppose, men and boys to be kind of proactive in reflecting on their own behaviour and how that could be kind of changed in healthier directions and in kind of challenging the behaviour of their peers as well, to help to actually get to the roots of things like violence against women. Because based on the idea that actually, even if we're not perpetrating violence ourselves, you know, we all play a part in creating the kind of culture that we live in. And if that culture is quite, you know, sexist or unequal, then actually we can all play a part in making that culture more kind of more equal and more healthy and kind of an environment where, like, I suppose, healthier ideas of masculinity are promoted. And an environment where kind of if somebody does make a sexist comment or if somebody does diminish violence against women or kind of jokes about it, you know, where those things are actually challenged and it's therefore made explicit that this is something which is unacceptable. Because unfortunately, at the moment, I think many of the cultures which we exist within, you know, that message isn't given out enough. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that these systems, or do you know if these systems are they present in schools or universities, as well as, I guess, sort of men's help group? But or if they aren't present, do you think that they should be introduced into, say, a school curriculum or sort of PSHE kind of classes or courses that you could do at university?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there is some stuff going on currently, but I don't think it's anywhere near enough, personally. You know, when you look at the scale of the issues which we're talking about, you know, something like domestic abuse is incredibly prevalent in our society, and same with other forms, like things like sexual violence as well, for example. And if you look at, you know, purely from a kind of from an economic standpoint, what does that cost our society? You know, let alone all of the harm it causes to people. Lives, it has huge impacts, and yet we don't really invest much at all in this stuff, you know. And actually, prevention, I mean, I know it's a stereotype, isn't it, that prevention is better than cure kind of thing, but actually prevention doesn't cost that much, and if you think about, you know, the long-term positive effects it can have, it is something which is really worth investing in. But yeah, if you I suppose working with young people is the obvious place to start with this, to try and change some, you know, unhealthy attitudes and ideas before they really become, you know, deeply embedded. We have just seen sex and relationships education made mandatory here in the UK, which is obviously a great step. I mean, you could question why it's taken until 2021 for that to happen, or 2020, I think it was introduced. Still, that is a positive step, because obviously that's a key place where these conversations can be started. But even then, I suppose there's a question of, well, actually, to what extent is that really being invested in and taken seriously as a subject, which actually really does give young people a real opportunity to actually learn and engage with these issues. And I suppose for me, a key thing would be, you know, to what extent are these gender norms and stereotypes being kind of talked about and addressed and challenged, I'm dubious about the extent to which that is going to happen, even within the new kind of sex and relationships education, which is kind of being brought in. So I think there's room for so much more of that, really, you know. And that I suppose that sex and relationships education, PSHE, is a great place to do that. But I don't think it should be left to that either, because actually you could be raising these things across the whole curriculum. In English, you could be saying, well, why is it that, you know, we focus so much on, you know, male authors? Yeah, why is women's writing not a bigger part of the curriculum? Or looking at, you know, at literature, and, well, what kind of gender stereotypes are present in this? Or is this book actually challenging some of our preconceived ideas of gender? You know, and that's just one subject, isn't it? I think there's scope for so much more of this work, both as a kind of key area of focus and also kind of as part of other subjects. So there is great stuff going on, not least the work of organisations like Changing Relations, really. And you've also got other organisations like the Good Lad Initiative, or they've just changed their name to Beyond Equality. So they do work specifically with men and around masculinity, and they started out doing that in universities. There is some good stuff going on out there, but I think we need a lot more of it, basically.
I definitely agree with that. You mentioned a little bit about how the impact of gender norms on men's violence against women. Could you sort of expand on that a little bit and how those things are connected?
Yeah. So I think this is really key to how I understand violence and abuse, and how lots of academic research kind of shows that these things are connected. So I suppose it's the idea that, you know, first of all, if we look at, you know, who's doing most violence in society, well, that is predominantly men. And that's certainly the case in relation to, you know, the different forms of violence against women, such as domestic abuse and sexual violence. So the vast majority of perpetrators are men. So there must be something there about being a man in society, which somehow, you know, makes that violence somehow kind of a viable option for them to consider, in a way which it doesn't seem to be for women, because women don't perpetrate anywhere near as much violence. And that's not something which is biological, because because not all men are perpetrating violence, and that violence varies quite a lot in the forms that it takes as well. So there must be something going on there about being a man in society, which then brings us to the question of masculinity. And so how do we construct masculinity in society? You know, how do we define being a man in ways which might encourage violence and abuse, perhaps, or normalize that, or make that seem kind of natural or acceptable or even kind of desirable, I suppose. And so I think, so basically for me, we have to look at how it is that we're defining masculinity. And there's so many things there which I think do feed into encouraging or normalizing violence. So for example, I think we still often define being a man as being powerful, being in control, you know, whether that's of yourself, you know, or the idea that you should always be in control and on top of things, the idea that somebody should wear the trousers in a relationship, and that typically that's the man, you know, if it's a heterosexual relationship, a man is the one making most of the decisions and has more power. And if they don't, then somehow they're whipped or, you know, somehow their masculinity is brought into question if they're not the one who's making, who's got more power. And so I think that those, like these gender norms, you know, really kind of impact on us quite deeply, because we learn them as soon as we're born. You know, we learn as soon as we're born, we're taught that, you know, there are big differences between girls and boys. And if you don't conform to those ideas, you know, then you might face punishments or something, and you might not be deemed very manly. You might be called gay or other very kind of gendered, you know, terms. You might be bullied and so on. So I suppose, yeah, there's that pressure to conform to that. And if you're not, if you feel like you're not living up to those standards, then you can feel quite insecure, and that can be a real source of discomfort, I suppose, for people. So in terms of violence, I think often violence by men is a way of basically trying to prove their masculinity, either to themselves if they feel insecure about it, or to perhaps to other people, to other men, for example. And I think violence against women is a big part of that. It is fundamentally is so often about exerting power and control over women, because perhaps men feel like that they have an expectation that they will have that power, and that they feel perhaps entitled to that because of all of these sexist ideas going around as well, that somehow, you know, men are entitled to have more power than women. Those ideas still float around. And so, yeah, if they feel that somehow that power is being challenged, perhaps then they might exert violence and abuse. And I suppose, you know, men using violence is rather than that being some deviation from the kind of masculine norms, that kind of dominant ideas about what it means to be a man, it's actually kind of overconforming to those norms to use violence. So I suppose men who buy in more rigidly to ideas of masculinity, to dominant ideas of masculinity in society, are more likely to perpetrate violence. You know, research shows that.
Obviously, you know, we've got COVID going on, and all of the restrictions because of that. And now we're in lockdown number 3. Everyone's stuck at home, and almost predictably, cases of domestic violence in particular have really, really increased. Has that changed the way you look at the work you're doing, or sort of how has it changed? Because it's this sort of other element of violence against women or gendered violence that you, I guess, we couldn't have predicted.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think for me, it very much connects with what I was just talking about, really, that if so much violence is about exerting power and control over other people, and in this case, over women, then, you know, I think a key thing is that, well, first of all, the pandemic, unfortunately, has created a lot more opportunities for that control to be exerted, right? Like, if you think about lockdowns, it's achieving a lot of the things which, you know, we use this concept of coercive control in relation to domestic abuse, because so often at the heart of domestic abuse is coercion and control, like keeping the victim trapped, and keeping them isolated, and so kind of, you know, completely detaching them from their friends and family and support networks, and that kind of emotional and psychological abuse, which is often, you know, that can actually at the center of domestic abuse, you know, there doesn't need to be physical violence at all, because that emotional and psychological abuse is already having such a kind of toll kind of thing. So in the context of the pandemic and especially under lockdown restrictions, that's really fed into that control, and it's made it a lot easier, I suppose. You know, for example, if a victim, the place where they would, maybe the one place where they could kind of get a bit of freedom from that abusive context would be their workplace. But if we're all working from home, you know, then that's that source of freedom has been completely lost as well. So and then they have even less access to their support networks, whatever they may be. It's harder to go out and reach out to a support service. Although that, you know, that is something which the government has now said people are allowed to do under lockdown conditions. It's still obviously something which is not easy at all. So there's that factor, but then also I think there's another factor as well that I think all of us, you know, a big thing at the moment is that we've lost a sense of control over our lives, right? And I think we all need that to some degree. You know, we all need a sense of like self-determination and that we do have, you know, some sense of control over what we can do, and I suppose, yeah, I suppose my idea is that that's particularly, there's more pressure there for men. There's an expectation that men should be in control, not just of themselves but of other people, and I think, you know, the pandemic has shaken up a lot of our norms and expectations on a day-to-day basis, a lot of us have lost that sense of control. And so if you're a man who is really buying into this idea that I need to have power and control over my life and over other people in my life, then perhaps the pandemic, you know, in these situations of crisis, you might be more determined to exert that control over other people as well. So I think that's a factor as well that's going on in terms of this real exacerbation of domestic abuse during this time. And it means that there's a risk then as well that when the lockdowns ease and people are more able to go out again, and perhaps if for a victim of domestic abuse, they are more able to leave that situation, that could again mean that perpetrators actually increase their abuse because they're fearful that control could be lost. And that's a real risky time as well in case of domestic abuse, if the perpetrator feels that they're control is being lost. So yeah, I think those are some of the key factors in relation to domestic abuse. But I think, yeah, you're right as well. The pandemic has really kind of challenged a lot of the ways in which we look at all sorts of different issues, hasn't it? So I think there are potential positives as well. You know, for example, you know, lots of men might have got more involved in childcare during this time because they are working from home and because the schools are closed. So they're having to get more involved in that. And we've seen, you know, that kind of the amount of care work that's been increased during this time has fallen, you know, massively on women. And there's that real risk of increasing gender inequality in the longer term, because it's had a real effect on women's ability to work and be in the workplace. And lots more women have lost their jobs than men as well, economically speaking. But still, I think that for at least some men, they have got more involved in being a father, and hopefully that could lead to, you know, some shifts in masculine norms over time as well. You know, men being more kind of engaged in childcare and perhaps other forms of care as well. You know, like being involved in the community, looking after your neighbours or other family members. You know, I think lots of people are having to do that more, aren't they? And so maybe that could push us towards embracing kind of care more as a society, which I think is really important in terms of shifting some of the unhealthy gender norms that we have at the moment. Yeah,
I think you raise a really interesting point there, that the aftermath of the pandemic could actually raise more awareness for creating opportunities for masculine expectations of gender norms to change, like you say. So making paternity leave more I guess, more attractive to men. I don't think it's really advertised or promoted in the same way that it is to women. And if for structures like that, if men are also taking advantage of these systems such as paternity leave, then that's sort of the way towards equality. If both men and women are taking advantage of the same opportunities for looking after each other, really, I think that's really, really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say that's a key thing, really, in terms of changing gender norms is for men to take up more of that parental leave. And I suppose that there is a kind of there's a question about the norms there, changing the norms so that it is more, you know, normalized for men to do that. But there's a kind of structural thing there as well, that actually there's a need for organizations, employers and the government, policymakers to make it easier for men to do that, and to really, as you say, to promote that and make sure that leave is actually available. I mean, at the moment, paternity leave is only 2 weeks, for example. And just to make it a lot easier for families to actually be able to kind of share that leave between them in a more equal way as well, yeah.
I think what's often sort of forgotten or not really talked about is that men are also victims of violence or even sexual violence. What sort of means of support are sort of available to male victims or should be made available? Or I get the impression that there aren't enough of these sort of systems in place.
Yeah, that's a great question. I suppose partly there should be the same kind of support which is available for female victims. Although I think that a lot of research shows that it tends to be more effective if it is kind of gender specific, gender sensitive, because, you know, male victims might have slightly different needs or they might find it quite difficult to it's difficult for any victim, but, you know, there are issues there again around masculinity, actually, where men might find it really hard to come forward if they have experienced some form of violence and abuse, because it's not seen as a very manly thing to do, to ask for help or to be a victim or to show any sign of perceived kind of weakness, which obviously you might really feel that if you are a victim of abuse and that somehow your masculinity has been brought into question by that. So I think those kind of things are really important to take into account in terms of supporting male victims to make it as easy as possible for them to do that. But there is some great support out there in that regard. There is great support available for male victims so there are different services for it depending on what form of abuse they've experienced. So for example, there's the Men's Advice Line for male victims of domestic abuse, which is a great service. If you just Google Men's Advice Line, they've got a great website, and that's a really good helpline. And then there are kind of there are local support services available for male victims of domestic abuse, you know, kind of similar in a way to what would be there for female victims. But yeah, there's certainly not enough of it at all, I don't think. And I think you're absolutely right that we've got a lot of work to do as a society to kind of to recognise that men can be victims and to actually make sure that the support is available for them. But I suppose there is a risk then of kind of, because, you know, unfortunately, I think some people kind of weaponize this issue and use it as a way of somehow kind of criticizing feminism or women's kind of anti-violence efforts, because the truth is there isn't enough support available who's a victim of domestic abuse or sexual violence. You know, that's another area where there's so little investment, and it's really and it's really been affected as well by like years of austerity and government cuts to like local government, for example, which is where a lot of the funding for these services come from. So I think there's a real need. There is great work being available out there and there is great support available, but it's very kind of disparate. It very much varies on your local area in terms of what's available. And there's a real need. I think there's a real need for more investment across the board for all victims of violence and abuse to have, you know, good quality specialist services available to them. And then there's also a need for those services to be kind of gender sensitive as well. So you know, for specific services to be available for male victims.
So Stephen, we talked a bit about sexual violence, and I really wanted to talk to you about sexual violence at university and particularly Durham University, which is where we're based. I think Durham University is potentially the worst for incidents of sexual misconduct. And, you know, that's something that hasn't that has been in the news a lot recently and hasn't really been tackled, particularly at the beginning of the academic year. There was sort of some news about a group chat where there were these fresher men who were sort of placing bets on, you know, who could sleep with the poorest girl and all these awful statements. And I don't think very much was done about it to punish the perpetrators. And I think that's related to what you were saying before about sort of men overcompensating for masculinity. And I think in this case, at especially at Durham, where lad culture goes too far and men sort of encourage each other to, you know, when they think that they're not going to be caught in these group chats. What's your thoughts about Durham University and, you know, how prevalent sexual violence is?
I mean, this is something which I think it's an issue, you know, at universities across the country. And there's been a lot of great campaigning from students and staff to some extent around raising awareness about this and getting universities to take more action, because for a long time they haven't been doing anything, and I think they're starting to do things, but there's still a long way to go, as you say. So I think there is a question there about, so I suppose before I was talking about like gender norms across society, but it's important to recognise that gender norms do vary quite a lot, you know, in different contexts. And so I suppose, you know, in universities, there are particular sets of gender norms going on there, and particular forms of masculinity, for example, a particularly kind of encouraged or dominant, and so as you say, there's this idea of lad culture that basically means that, you know, being quite sexist and being kind of hyper masculine, perhaps, you know, so that it's often attached with things like sports societies or kind of a big kind of drinking culture, that part of those norms as well is sexism and homophobia and a kind of a condoning of sexual violence. Some academics have used the idea of like a conducive context, you know, that universities actually provide a kind of conducive context for sexual violence to take place because of the norms which are going on there. And I think you're right as well to highlight Durham in particular, because as you say, like research has suggested that it is a big problem everywhere, but it's a really big problem at Durham, and perhaps there's something there about this just highlights as well, I suppose, the need for a kind of intersectional approach to all of this, you know, recognizing that gender inequality is always interconnecting and interacting with other systems of power and inequality as well, like based on social class or racism, for example. And so I think we see these things often, you know, intersecting with each other, and these things compounding each other. And that was definitely the case with that group chat you spoke about, didn't it? That if young men are kind of encouraged to like look down on women, then that is even more encouraged in relation to like women from lower income or working class backgrounds. So those attitudes were kind of compounding each other, weren't they, with those group chats. And the flip side of that as well, in terms of who has more power and privilege, I suppose if men in general might be encouraged to have a sense of entitlement to things like to sex or to women's bodies or affections, you know, that might be encouraged even more among men who are more privileged in other ways as well, to have that kind of sense of entitlement. So I think these are huge issues at Durham, because it's not a very diverse university at all. And unfortunately, yeah, I think the university has a lot of work to do to actually address, to take seriously these issues, to recognise that they are major issues on campus, and to look at itself as well, you know, how do the structures of the university perhaps themselves help to encourage or kind of condone this kind of culture, you know, if men are dominating the leadership positions at the university, or if the university has a huge gender pay gap, which it does, you know. So gender inequality is embedded in the structures of the university. So I suppose that shows how these things link at different levels, you know, at structural level, in a kind of cultural level, and then in individual attitudes and behaviours. And so I think the point is, in terms of prevention, is that we need to address all of those things if we can really create a kind of culture change where sexual violence on campus is actually really tackled in a serious way.
I'd absolutely agree with that. Durham is an incredibly homogenous place to be.
It's ranked second worst in the country for social inclusion, which is terrible. And that suggests to me a sort of an excess of privilege that really leads to, you know, these high rates of sexual violence. I've also noticed around sort of the university sort of area, I don't know if you've ever seen the Durham SU like tote bags, which say things like, never have I ever walked home alone, and all of these sort of campaigns. I guess about the potential for violence in around Durham University, but I also felt like it was more about sort of safety and a little bit of victim blaming in these cases, saying, you know, if you did walk home alone and something happened to you, then, you know, that's your fault. And I think surely we should be teaching men or just people not to be violent towards each other rather than, you know, to stay out of the way of violence. So what practical measures or what can we do at Durham to start to end men's violence against women?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I totally agree with you as well about what you're saying there about these ideas about, you know, don't walk home alone and stuff like that. Because, I mean, in reality, I mean, that's not about prevention at all, really, is it? Because what that's basically saying is, you know, if the perpetrator is then just going to target somebody else, right? Somebody who is walking home alone. So it's not, you know, it's not actually addressing the source of the problem in terms, because the only source of the problem is somebody choosing to use violence and abuse in the first place, right? The only way you can actually stop that from happening is by stopping somebody from making that choice in the first place. So I totally agree that those kind of messages can be very victim blaming, actually, and aren't actually addressing the roots of the problem. And so that's why I'm particularly interested in engaging men and boys on these issues, because, you know, if most of the violence is perpetrated by men, then that is where the source of the problem lies, really, doesn't it? And that's not about blaming men or saying that individual men are somehow to blame for this. It's saying that the society we have, the culture we have, the ideas of masculinity that we have, those are the things which need to be changed. And we can do that by working with men and boys on these issues. And of course, working with everyone in society. So I think there's a need for more of that, basically, at Durham. As I said, the university has made some progress. Now we've got things like consent workshops. But, you know, I think basically that's still quite piecemeal compared to the scale of the problem. You know, like a 1-hour consent workshop or whatever, unfortunately, that's great, but it's not going to change these very deep-rooted attitudes and norms and behaviours on its own. So I think we need much more work of that kind, really. You know, we need like ongoing prevention work. I think we need these things embedded into the university curriculum, really. So, you know, perhaps not just addressing issues of sexual violence, but that curriculum could also address other things as well, like racism, for example. You know, there's a whole range of different issues which could be addressed actually in a really interesting and powerful way, you know, which students could actually get a lot out of. And I think that actually they do that quite a bit better in the US. I think that there has been more kind of development in that regard in the US in terms of prevention work in this area. Although I think maybe that was perhaps challenged a little bit under the Donald Trump administration, but that's a separate issue. So I think for me that's what we need more of. And that's for all students as well, because we've also seen things like, you know, kind of bystander intervention initiatives. So encouraging anybody to reflect on, well, what can I do as a bystander to challenge, you know, sexual violence or the behaviours that kind of feed into it. But that's, I think at the moment, that's very much perhaps that's only at specific colleges, and it's only targeted at specific leadership figures or groups, for example, like sports team captains. And of course, those people are particularly good to get on board. But really, I think we need everybody to be engaging with this stuff on an ongoing, long-term basis. And as I said, that needs to be tackling harmful gender norms needs to be a key part of that, and it needs to be broader than just doing that face to face engagement work as well. It needs to be looking at the gender inequalities in the university structures, and actually it needs to look at staff as well, right? Because staff can also perpetrate or experience sexual violence or other forms of violence and abuse. So there needs to be a lot of training and engagement there for staff as well to try and tackle these things. So I think, as I said, we've made a start, but there's a long way to go. And those are some of the things I would suggest in that regard. Yeah.
Yeah, I've definitely seen sort of, especially in the light of the Black Lives Matter protests of last year, a lot of sort of decolonizing the departments is going on. And I still think there's definitely, you know, a way to go, but it's starting, you know, it's a start. And also the Consent Matters and also an Active Bystander course, which I had to do to apply for a role in college. But I sort of wonder whether it should actually be made compulsory for every student, maybe every year, who enter, like when you come into the university, that everyone should do it, not just people who are applying for roles of responsibility in college.
Yeah, because otherwise, I suppose you've got the risk that only people who are already quite on board with these ideas will be the ones who actually voluntarily take up the course, really, won't it? So I think it does need to be compulsory, really. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and as another sort of thought that I've had in talking to friends or just seeing online in the world, is that men can often respond quite negatively to feminist ideas, or even just the term feminism, because it, I think there's sort of this assumption that it's about, you know, reversing the power sort of structures so that actually, you know, women are going to be more powerful than men, or and men are going to lose power or be disadvantaged in some way because of feminism, which makes them quite, I guess, an ignorance, which might make men quite reluctant to fight for, I guess, equality. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think there's a few things there which you know, I would kind of raise. I mean, I think basically, fundamentally, I think all of us want to live in a society which is as equal and as fair and as just as possible, right? And there are lots of different ways in which that isn't the case with society as it is currently. And I think for people who have more power and privilege, like men, we're kind of perhaps brought up in ways where we don't really see that that's the case, because, you know, people who have more privilege tend not to actually understand that if we don't have firsthand experience of oppression or inequality, then I suppose somehow that thing can feel very detached from our lives, or we don't feel like it's relevant to us, or perhaps we don't even believe that it is the case, and there's lots of misinformation as well, and kind of ideas about feminism which are kind of, you know, basically not accurate at all, but that can give people a kind of an inaccurate idea about what it's about. So I think that's a kind of hurdle which needs to be overcome, is actually showing men and boys why this is relevant to all of our lives and how we're all affected by these things on a day-to-day basis. And all of us, you know, to some extent, we do play a part in contributing to the culture of the society that we live in. And so that does mean that we can all be complicit to some extent, you know, in reproducing like harmful gender norms, for example, you know, completely unintentionally, but we might all play a part in that at times. So that also means, therefore, that there are things we can all do actually to positively change that culture and to change society in more equal directions. And that could be all sorts of different things. You know, that could be on a day-to-day basis. If you encounter some quite kind of rigid or stereotypical ideas about masculinity, you know, you can challenge that. Or if you hear a sexist comment, you can question that. Or, you know, at a bigger level, you can campaign for your university or your organization to tackle issues like sexual violence and to take them more seriously and things like that. But, and I suppose then as well, you know, there's a lot that men ourselves have to gain from doing that, right? Like, I think the way that society is organized at the moment in relation to gender is actually very harmful for men and boys. I mean, obviously we have more power than women as a whole in society, so it's that weird kind of contradiction, isn't it, that on the one hand we benefit from the current system, but at the same time it holds us back in all sorts of ways as well because of those ideas of masculinity, you know, that most men actually are always struggling quite hard to live up to those expectations because they're unrealistic and they don't really fit with being achieving our full kind of humanity, I think, you know. So actually being, you know, if we were able to be more, you know, to be able to communicate more with each other, to be able to really embrace the range of emotions that we experience, to be encouraged to embrace, like, you know, really kind of full relationships with other people in our lives, you know, whether that's children or family members or partners or whoever, you know, and for those to be kind of, you know, equal caring relationships where you feel able to communicate and speak how you feel without that somehow not being labeled as a very manly thing to do or whatever. I think, you know, men have huge amounts to gain from that and to get closer to our own kind of humanity, really, and which unfortunately I think the current society really, you know, discourages us from doing. And obviously that has harmful effects on men and boys, and then it has harmful effects on everyone around them as well, when those things are then expressed outwardly in terms of violence, for example. But at the same time, so I think we do need to recognize that, you know, men do need to give up power and privilege in some ways. But at the same time, that's not a situation where we're really losing, because actually, you know, I think all of us do want to live in an equal and fair society where everybody has equal opportunities and rights. And actually, as I say, I think we have a lot to gain as well by kind of losing some of the shackles of these harmful ideas of masculinity, really. So, yeah, that's what I would say, I guess.
That's some really interesting things to think about there. I think that's definitely been a sort of learning curve for me throughout doing this podcast, is that sort of, yes, feminism is about breaking down, you know, the current sort of white supremacist patriarchal systems of power, and that feminism benefits everyone, but it's not just about sort of marginalized people being brought up, but actually that it doesn't always benefit men. And I think that's something that I really haven't realized in the past. Dr. Stephen Brother, thank you so much for being on the podcast with me. Is there anything, just any other thoughts that you feel like you want to add, that you want to say to the world?
No, I mean, thank you very much for listening. And I suppose, yeah, maybe I'd just finish by re-emphasizing the point that I think there are things we can all do on a day-to-day basis in our lives. You know, these issues are relevant to all of us. So I would just encourage people, yeah, to start thinking, if I'm sure many people are already doing this, but whether you are or you're not, you know, just to, when you encounter ideas about gender, you know, even if it's very small things like the toys which are offered to girls and boys when they're children, or the films that we watch, or the books that we read, you know, what ideas are those giving out about gender? And actually, are those healthy, and are those equal? And if they're not, then what can we do to challenge those, really?
Yeah. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of the Hidden Agenda podcast. This episode actually concludes our mini-series, but do look out for more work by Changing Relations on their social media pages. They're doing some really amazing things to do with all of the topics that have been discussed throughout the podcast episodes, so do go and check them out. Thank you so much for listening.